This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Taking a look at the issues surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQ+ communities. This is Well Well Well, brought to you by the team from Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network.
Nathan Despot is a co-founder of Brave Network, a support and advocacy group for survivors of conversion practices, and SOGIS Survivors, a group that advocates for effective legislation to end conversion practices around Australia. Nathan is a survivor of 10 years of conversion practices and was one of the designers of the survivor-led model of legislation that was adopted in Victoria and New Zealand, and in part in the ACT and New South Wales. He has been a researcher working at La Trobe University's National Conversion Ideology and Practices Research Project since 2020. Nathan is also head of policy, research and advocacy at disability organisation Inclusion Melbourne, and was named Outstanding Leader of the Year at the 2023 National Disability Awards. From 2029 to 22, he co-managed the world's largest government-funded project centering LGBTIQA+ people with intellectual disability. Quite the dance card, Nathan. Thank you so much for joining us here on Well, Well, Well.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
It's beautiful to have you on to kind of give us a little bit of introspective into the lived experience of people who are survivors of conversion practices, to obviously complement the first half of tonight's program, which was centered around the report that Equality Australia has put together on religious discrimination, religious freedoms, and the impacts on LGBTQ+ communities. I've mentioned a little bit about your kind of backstory there, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, the Brave Network, and I guess your advocacy towards ensuring the well-being of LGBTQ+ people of faith?
Well, so I'm a Melbourne boy, grew up here, Maltese family background, I did go through 10 years of conversion practices, but that wasn't in the Catholic world I was raised in. That was a bit later, from when I was 18, in the evangelical world, which myself and some other folks around me sort of found our way into. And, you know, the time after that is part of the, I guess, the trauma story, trauma, highs, lows, healing, recovery, all the rest of it. But I feel a little bit disconnected from that. It's time has passed. But I would say that the focus for me now is a lot more around education and awareness around conversion practices, but also what it means to be a queer person of faith. I think I'm also interested in the fact that so much of what drives conversion practices and some of the more insidious, tricky discrimination we're seeing sort of played out and advocated for by conservatives in politics in Australia, you know, a lot of that, the background knowledge you need to understand that kind of stuff is not something that we in Australia have a lot of, at least not till recently. It requires knowing a lot about what it's like being inside that world of being in, you know, the evangelical Christian world or the fundamentalist world, if it's not Christian. A lot of it is American, but also from other places as well, particularly if it's a Christian evangelical background. And so I feel like these days I spend less time thinking about what it was like going through conversion practices and more around this culture that I was part of, with its secret handshake, so to speak, and its language and vocabulary and all that kind of thing. And a lot of the work of Brave Network, which has supported survivors for a number of years, but also queer people of faith who aren't survivors of conversion practices, has really been kind of joining the dots and understanding what the heck is it that I went through? What the heck was that? What do I still believe? And helping people understand the strange, bizarre tapestry that's kind of been woven in their minds through the blending of all these different religious and cultural influences. And a large part of the healing journey and recovery is actually recognizing all of that stuff, basically. So
yeah definitely. And I know SOGI Survivors has developed kind of ethical guidelines for people who are engaging with survivors of conversion practices. Obviously, advocating for this community forms a large part of the work that you do, but what led this particular project in developing these guidelines?
So we found that a lot of the understanding that media, politicians, journalists, even queer community leaders had about conversion practices or religious discrimination, it came from these sort of not so evangelical reference points, like people maybe having a sort of light Catholic upbringing in the suburbs or a sort of more traditional Anglican upbringing or something like that, as opposed to being in that evangelical world. We also found that people's knowledge came from watching movies that kind of fetishized the experience of conversion survivors. So sort of really extreme stuff that probably doesn't happen in anywhere near as much, if at all, in Australia. And so we found that you would see advocates or politicians or media looking for these horror stories, which would often re-traumatize survivors, but also in seeking those things, missing the key point, which is that this ideology that underpins conversion practices has spread far and wide, and it's all around us, hiding in plain sight. And so, you know, those guidelines have sort of been helpful in sort of saying, you know, stop just asking us about gay white men who have been to a formal church program. Talk to us about the more insidious conversion practices that have occurred for people from other parts of our community, for example.
Yeah. How hard is it to kind of unpack this problem as a whole when obviously we've had things come into play that have, you know, banned conversion practices, particularly here in Victoria, but when some of that more kind of insidious stuff is really entrenched in the ideology of a particular faith that might not technically be a conversion practice, but, you know, all the same flavors and things are there, what do we still have to do to, I guess, unpack or unravel that kind of way of thinking?
So, I mean, what you're really talking about is the heart of the strategy that advocates have and survivor advocates have sort of prosecuted over the last 5 or 6 years, which is to reframe conversion practices and ideology as a whole. So the short summary would be that conversion practices are practices that are grounded in an ideology, and that ideology usually has a few components in it. And it's pretty consistent. This is from the research project, from years of advocacy, storytelling, what have you. Firstly, there's some sort of cultural information usually. So it could be some theological ideas about sin, hell, or whatever it might be. Some pseudoscientific stuff about the causes of what made you queer. Childhood abuse or trauma or neglect or something like that. And then some sort of exhortation to do something about it, like, you can't be part of this community, you aren't acceptable to our culture or family or faith community, church, synagogue, mosque, if you are queer, so you've got to do something about it. And so it doesn't really matter what the religious or theological idea is. It's basically this idea that there's some sort of damage and you either need to change your identity or suppress it deeply. And therefore, a conversion practice is any practice that is grounded in that ideology and that intention to change or suppress someone's orientation or gender identity. And this has been really important because most of the practices that conversion practices are disguised as, or what they look like, usually are practices that, if they didn't have that motivation, would be kind of okay, like prayer or pastoral care or that kind of thing, or counseling. They're all fine if they're not underpinned by this intention to change or suppress someone's orientation or gender, or this idea that you're broken. And so reframing it has been so helpful. I still remember during the debate in Victorian Parliament in the upper house, it was a 13-hour beast of a debate in early 2021. And Jacqueline Symes, the absolutely incredible Attorney General who was brand new to that post in Victoria, and stood there for hours while people threw ridiculous questions at her. What about this? Will this be banned? Is that banned? Will parents go to jail for this? Can you not, you're not allowed to pray with someone if they ask a question about the sexuality? And she just repeatedly said, if it's a practice that has the intention of change or suppression, blah, blah, you know, like over and over again for hours. So yeah.
Just really not allowing the situation to be catastrophized beyond what really the aims of the reduction of conversion practices are. Yeah. In talking with Equality Australia and their report that we talked about earlier in the program, amongst some institutions, there was an identified, I guess, quote unquote, need to help young people accept their body as created in air quotes. Do you worry about these, you know, future statutes and things that might protect religious freedoms kind of creating an unintended backdoor into conversion practices?
Yeah, so there's some questions here. I mean, this might sound like a moot point, but it's important to understand that as advocates, we need to tunnel through a lot of that garbage and some of these smokescreen ideas and bring it back to the fact that there is a large cohort in our society that believes that you cannot be trans ever. Like, trans never is real. And it's important to distinguish that from this idea that they're trying, some of those proponents of, well, I would say proponents of conversion practices, when they talk about protecting young people, you know, protecting young people from coming out as trans too early when they're quote unquote not sure, right? That's not really the truth. What's really behind that is trans people don't really exist. And if it's about sexual orientation, then it's only ever an experience of sexuality that is caused by trauma. So it's important to get down to that, to understand the core intentions. I think when it comes to, I'll bring it back to the conversion legislation. In Victoria, our legislation allows health practitioners, psychologists, pediatricians to do some kind of exploration and ask questions if it's in line with their code of ethics and the ethical guidelines. And the ethical guidelines are pretty clear that trans identity is real and does exist. And so if you are coming from a perspective where you have already decided that it is not possible to ever be trans, then you are kind of already breaching that code. And there's lots more in there that means that you're in breach of your code as well, right? So I feel like, you know, short of going into a hour-long answer to your question, I think it's important to bring it back to what are the motivations and what are the regulations and codes that already exist. My fear has been in the past, but I've got a lot more faith now as I've seen governments over the years across Australia grapple with this issue. They're beginning to now feel more confident with separating out the fears and these cultural ideas or religious ideas from the pseudoscience and the breaches of codes of ethics, and becoming a lot more, you know, political advisors that SOGI Survivors has engaged with over the years, they're becoming a lot more confident with being able to parse these things out. It doesn't necessarily stop the hysteria hitting the, you know, the front page, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. I'm continuing my conversation with Nathan Despot, co-founder of The Brave Network, which extends beautifully into my next question that I wanted to ask you around the work that The Brave Network does. And for several years, I know Brave Network has hosted, you know, monthly meetings to bring together LGBTQA plus people of faith together. How important is that community building in supporting survivors?
We don't have, you know, regular face-to-face meetings monthly anymore, not for the last couple of years, but for many years, so 7 years or so we did. And I think I mentioned earlier that it's been really important for people understanding or, you know, deconstructing some of the old views they had. I'd say more than half definitely still have a strong faith, and it's a very grounded personal faith. The research project that I've been working on with La Trobe University has had a lot of engagement with Brave, and the findings of that research project is definitely that there's a strong yearning for spirituality still amongst survivors of conversion practices. But I think going back to that point that meeting together has allowed people to work out, okay, so what did I go through in my experience of conversion? How is it different to what that person went through? What was I told about my sexuality, and what does recovery look like, and why do I keep having these triggered moments that are so difficult to explain to other people? And oh wow, you have those triggered moments too, let's talk about it. So that's been really helpful, but it also in hindsight really formed this incredible foundation for advocacy. And I'm so proud some of these survivors, many of whom, you know, are professionals and do advocacy in their professional life. But so many of them just really stepped up to the plate when it came to advocating with government and speaking to media, and were always the best at getting across the right, you know, key messages and that kind of thing. And I realize now that all that community building was the foundation of that.
Yeah. The Change or Suppression or Conversion Practices Prohibition Act came into effect in 2022. So with a couple of years under our belt of that coming into effect, what has the response been in the kind of existing survivor community? And then what are the kind of changes we've seen in our community amongst queer people of faith in that time?
I mean, the law has come into force and has been implemented for the last couple of years at the same time as there's been quite a cultural shift in Victoria and Australia relating to more progressive expressions, I guess, of faith, particularly of Christianity. But of course, there are also people who are, you know, from non-Protestant sort of Anglo-Saxon backgrounds who are still experiencing the same level of fear and a sense of feeling oppressed and having to hide in their communities. But there's definitely more services and more awareness out there across the board. The beauty of this legislation is that the measure of success is not how many people have you put in jail or that kind of thing. You know, survivors have always had a strong non-violent communication approach to government intervention in our advocacy. The real measure of success is the incredible legislatively mandated education sessions that have been delivered to community right across the board. So many sessions now for mental health professionals and a rollout of an incredible training package delivered by Jack Tomlins to faith communities and community leaders and pastoral care professionals. And I think that's the real sign of success, and the fact that this civil scheme, which is the main part of the legislation, is this incredible community education and social change and report investigating body, which is really what we wanted. So from that perspective, I'd say that it is going from strength to strength. And, you know, there are still parts of it that are coming together. But as other states and territories and even New Zealand have implemented this same model, there's a lot of synergy happening. So, yeah, it's looking good.
Yeah. Thinking about people who've experienced, you know, potentially years like yourself of the negative impacts of conversion practices, what are some of the negative health outcomes that you kind of hear from within community about how these conversion practices have impacted our queer community's health and well-being over the years?
Well, from the research perspective, I mean, a lot of the research has kind of confirmed or extended what many of us already knew. Obviously, depression, anxiety, that kind of thing. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder, complex trauma, which can be a bit different to other forms of PTSD. There's often a misunderstanding that the main driver of harm is what someone might have experienced in the actual practice. And for a small number of people, that is true. But really, it's the internalization of those messages. It's the experiences of community rejection and loss and grief that is ongoing. Also, really common issues with sexual function, for lack of a better term, maintaining relationships, failure to sort of thrive, or slow thriving, I guess, when it comes to education and employment. These are pretty consistent. And then also suicidality. And there is, you know, there are still people that I know who have taken their lives in recent years where they thought they were okay and then something triggered them. So I guess we also are beginning to understand that if you are a survivor of conversion practices, then being triggered can lead to some really extreme, rapid sort of declines, I guess, in terms of mental health. Could talk about that a lot. It's hard stuff.
Till the cows come home.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Thinking about people who are in faith-based organizations or faith communities that aren't of faith themselves, what role do allies have in that space in, you know, reporting this discrimination or advocating for change, reporting instances of this now criminalized conversion practice behavior? How, you know, and that might be in, you know, people have left the church or had a change of heart in attitudes. What role do they have to play in this kind of building of resilience?
Gosh, there's so many things. I mean, there's always a need for informed supporters and peer support of queer people of faith. Going back to, you know, the conversation around religious discrimination, particularly, you know, in schools or in any institution, one of the things that we've seen from the conservative side of our culture is this naming of this term religious ethos, which has been a way to sort of basically say, you know, we don't need to show evidence that this particular belief we hold or rule that we have in our community or culture or faith community or school or whatever, you know, we don't need to prove that it is grounded in our time-honored tradition or our theology or what have you. We can just say it's our ethos, part of how we work, and that can be, you know, slapped with a protected sort of stamp on it. I think it's important for allies who are still in faith communities to recognize this nonsense and to advocate and use their voice and to make a noise about that when they can. It is something that I think advocates have been successful at challenging over the last few years, but it seems to be something that's going to be around for a while. I think it's quite dangerous. But I would say, you know, if you're an ally listening, helping people connect up with services if they don't know where services are, there's, you know, if someone is a survivor of conversion practices, with very few exceptions, I'd say that they do need to have some kind of professional support or help or peer support or, you know, a counselor or something. So being a connector is great. But absolutely, I constantly hear stories of allies who have gone to the leader of a faith community and challenged them and said, you know, what you just said is actually not true and it's, you know, grounded in pseudoscience or it's harmful, or, you know, did you know that what you've said might seem benign to you, but actually we now know causes severe harm to queer people in our community. Those kinds of ways of being a upstander, not a bystander, really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautifully put. Where, if people are feeling really impassioned about this, or they're a person of faith themselves that's experienced some of this discrimination or these kind of behaviours, where can people go for more information to understand the well-being of LGBTQ people with of faith?
Mm. First of all, if you are a person who has witnessed conversion practices or experienced them, if you're in Victoria or the ACT, you can directly report to the Human Rights Commissions in Victoria or the ACT. In Victoria, the civil scheme is set up to be able to support referrals to mental health services, that kind of thing. There are a number of mental health bodies that now have an awareness of how to support survivors. You know, Queer Space and Thorn Harbour Health has also been building its capacity there as well. Brave Network, our website, thebravenetwork.org, is still there, and we still have an email address, and we get probably, you know, too many requests really for support. And then there's also plenty of Australian resources, such as the research website for the La Trobe University Research Project. And if people want to get in touch through Facebook, there's the Brave Network Melbourne Facebook page, and there's also the SOGIS Survivors .com.au website as well. So there's a lot more resources out there these days and a lot more groups that can offer support. You can also Google LGBTIQ affirming faith communities in Melbourne. There's plenty of lists out there and in other cities as well. So
fantastic. Yeah. Nathan Despot is a co-founder of the Brave Network and of SOGIS Survivors, a group that advocates for the effective legislation to end conversion practices across Australia. Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Well, Well, Well.
Thank you.
We will, of course, have a link to those many and varied resources Nathan has mentioned this week on the podcast. Just head to joy.org.au/well, well, well, where you can grab all of those links and, of course, access our 800 plus episodes of Well, Well, Well from the past. If you've got a topic or an issue impacting and surrounding the health and well-being of our LGBTIQA plus and people living with HIV communities, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email, wellwellwell@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to Well, 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 supported by Thorn Harbour Health on Joy and the Community Radio Network. For more LGBTIQ plus health and well-being and much more, check out Thorn Harbour on social media at Thorn Harbour or via the website thornharbour.org.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.